Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And the first headline on the front of the Triangle Business Journal, Why Mentoring Makes a Difference. Professional women label mentoring as the critical component to career success. And that's the cover story headline on the front page. The actual article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with a second headline in a section called Biz Women. The Art of Mentoring. Both sides of relationship receive valuable insight, experience. And this article is written by Ellen Sherberg. Mentoring makes a difference. That's what 82% of women professionals who participated in a LinkedIn study say, calling mentorship a critical component of career success. In fact, mentoring has been around since the word first appeared in Homer's epic poem The Odyssey, when Odysseus asked Mentor to watch over his son during the siege of Troy. Clearly, mentoring has moved beyond the classics into our schools, neighborhoods, and workplaces. Study after study demonstrates the importance of mentoring in the lives of children, particularly those from underprivileged backgrounds. Higher graduation rates and lower rates of incarceration are touted as major benefits of mentoring youth. Mentoring has migrated to the workplace as hundreds of companies, including consulting firm Deloitte and retailer Target Corporation, develop mentoring programs to attract and retain talent, especially where women are concerned. The most powerful women acknowledge their mentors. For example, technology executive and Lean In author Sheryl Sandberg pays homage to former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, for whom she worked in pre-Facebook days. And the youngest among us most actively seek mentors. That LinkedIn study shows more than half the Gen Y women between ages 18 and 29 say they currently are being mentored or have been mentored by other women. The number dips to 43% for Gen X women, ages 30 and 44, and drops to 34% for baby boomers who are between 45 and 66. They'll all be represented at Mentoring Monday, a national mentoring event under the banner of Biz Women and Triangle Business Journal on April 4. More than 10,000 women in 43 cities will participate. Their conversations likely will follow the patterns found in the LinkedIn study, showing that the number one reason women seek mentors is for professional guidance. They will also look for recommendations on everything from finance to fashion, career advice, industry trends, and last but not least, job opportunities. There are benefits for the mentors as well. A study published last year in the Journal of Vocational Behavior focuses on the advantages of being a mentor. Compared to colleagues who did not mentor, individuals who served as mentors within their workplace reported greater job satisfaction and commitment to their work. How do you know when mentoring is working? When you hear the voice of your mentor in your head and it becomes your own. And there are a few different sections with quotes along with this article. The first, the importance of mentorship. Why successful women place a priority on mentoring. I work in a male-dominated industry, and after many years, I am often still the only woman at the table. Helping more women be successful helps entire industries to evolve and strengthen. He believed in me more than I believed in myself, and it changed my life. We need women at all levels, including the top, to change the dynamic, reshape the conversation. Mentorship never ends and is a two-way street. I enjoy learning from our younger workforce, how they work, how they think, as much as I do sharing my experiences with them. And words of wisdom. Mentors offer guidance for other women. 1. When you believe in something, you must be willing to sacrifice everything to pursue it. 2. If it doesn't work out, trying to force it will bring you great suffering and failure. 3. Knowing the difference between 1 and 2 is the hardest thing in life. And then there are more quotes. Being broke is hard. Becoming wealthy is hard. Choose your hard. Live every day as if you were playing golf. Everyone is watching whether you play with integrity or kick the ball closer to the hole. If you think no one saw you kick the ball, they did. There are no shortcuts. Einstein's picture hangs on my wall in the office at eye level for a reason. Don't repeat the same things over and over and expect different results. Life is crazy enough without insanity. And lessons learned. Mentees relay their favorite mentor advice. Never let anyone convince you that people expect women to be nicer, so a woman leader cannot demand high standards. You can set a very high bar for performance without intimidation and yielding power, but by leading from the front and lifting people up to their maximum potential. Leadership is about three simple things. Get better, help others, and get better at helping others get better. In the business world, my friend, it's not whether you get hit hard, unfairly, and get brutally knocked down, because it will happen. What really matters is how quickly you get back up. And there's another article along with this cover story article. This one is headlined, "You Can't Do It Alone. Mentors, sponsors serve different roles, but both lead to career growth." And this article is written by Hillary Burns. When Morgan Stanley's Carla Harris offers advice on how to succeed in one's career, she is clear about one thing. You can't do it alone. In work, there are mentors and there are sponsors, said Harris, chair of the National Women's Business Council and a vice chairman of Global Wealth Management, managing director and senior client advisor at Morgan Stanley. You need both, and you need to know the difference between the two. Popular business press loves to say you need a mentor, but they don't tell you what a good mentor is supposed to do for you, or tell the difference between mentors and sponsorship, Harris said. You can survive a very long time in your career without a mentor, but you will not survive without a sponsor. Harris says that a mentor is the person you can tell the good, the bad, and the ugly to. You should feel comfortable sharing the intimate details of your career to this person, including goals and mistakes. By definition, it must be someone you can trust, Harris said. Don't just say, oh, she's been doing this 20 years, she'll be my mentor. If she doesn't know you very well, she cannot be a great mentor to you. The mentoring job is tailored advice specifically to you and your career aspirations. If you don't believe that person has your best interests at heart 100%, they can't be your mentor. Harris said that she has had one mentor for 25 years. She is a woman in a different business, but she understands Harris's job and wants nothing but the best for her. A sponsor is not the person you tell the good, the bad, and the ugly to, Harris said. They're the person you tell the good, and the good to. Harris explained that a sponsor is the person who carries your resume into the room when it comes time for a possible promotion. He or she is the person who will go out on a limb and vouch for you passionately behind closed doors. They're spending valuable political and social capital on you, and you have to articulate why you are worthy of that capital, Harris said. Retreat from looking for a sponsor until you can say why. Harris said when she was up for the promotion to managing director, she realized she needed someone who would vouch for her at the table. I started thinking about it. He is going to fight for him. She is going to fight for him. I couldn't say without a shadow of a doubt who was going to fight for me. Every year, someone is not going to get the promotion. Once Harris realized she needed to secure a sponsor, she went to someone who she knew had a seat at the decision-making table and made her case. I said, it's very important for me to be promoted this year. If he had told me no, he was going to have to tell me why, I said. I said, but you and I know that someone has to be behind the closed door pounding their fist for me. He appreciated her candor and agreed to be her sponsor. And I'm from the South, so I then went to someone else who also had a seat at that table, Harris said. I exercised my power and said, it's very important for me to be promoted this year. Never let it up to chance to let the organization decide. If you don't ask, you don't get it. And along with this article, there's some more quotes. These are from mentoring parents. Women share wisdom passed along by their original role models. My mom was an RN, and she came home one day covered in blood because she saved the life of a man who begged her in the ambulance not to let him die so he could raise his babies. Then she took a shower and fixed dinner. That's from Paula Barron, partner, Barron Liebman, LLP, Portland. Don't tell anyone at your company you know how to make coffee or fix the copy machine. That's from Valerie Ramsbacher, Senior Vice President, Corporate Advocacy, Regions, Birmingham. My dad taught me about real life on the tennis court, to play fairly, enjoy the game, hit within the lines, develop a strategy, contribute to a team, and perform under pressure. Linda Gorenz-Levy, partner, General Capital Group, Milwaukee. If you're going to make a mistake, make it a loud one. And that's from Amy Novak, partner, operations manager, Google Incorporated, Pittsburgh. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Rebecca Troyer. The main article, a chat with actress Sharon Lawrence, a question and answer column. Biz recently caught up with accomplished stage, film, and television actress Sharon Lawrence, a Charlotte native who graduated from Broughton High School in Raleigh and UNC Chapel Hill. There has been a lot of discussion and debate about gender equality in the TV, film, theater industry. In your opinion, what are greatest obstacles or barriers to women in the field? My first professional experiences were in the musical theater world, which has always celebrated and even elevated female characters. I never perceived an overt sexism toward actresses during my early professional years, but I recognized that there were fewer female theatrical directors. Watching the Tony Awards over the last several years has been so exciting because women are winning the highest accolades as directors and producers, several of whom I have had the pleasure of collaborating with, Susan Stroman, Fran Waisler, Daryl Roth. As I moved into television, it became clear to me that while the image of women on the screen included the self-assured, career-driven gal who was able to balance a job, the kids, her love life, and good nature, all on her prominent shoulder pads, there was still a requirement for them to be traditionally attractive to the typical male audience. What I believe has shifted is the range of females who we are now able to identify with, from Kerry Washington on Scandal, Lena Dunham on Girls, Julia Louis-Dreyfus on Veep, to Robin Wright on House of Cards. That is progress. When stories for, by, and about women are valued for the good business they are proving to be, then the creators of that content will continue to have access to the ever-increasing pipelines through which to deliver their stories. There have been female studio and network executives opening up those pipelines for a few decades now, and people like Cindy Holland, head of series at Netflix, make me so proud. As for more women behind the camera, perhaps this is where the challenge of gender equality becomes more complicated. When the qualities of leadership, especially on a film set, are perceived without bias, then when a woman is at the helm, her decisiveness will no longer be viewed as being difficult. Her stamina will not be viewed as aggressiveness. Her clarity won't be characterized as being bossy, and her judgment won't be challenged at all quarters. I believe we're working toward that because I know what mentorship through programs like Women in Film and WeForShe.org are providing tools to develop women of vision like Ava DuVernay, Selma, Queen Sugar, Middle of Nowhere, into award-winning filmmakers, distributors. What are your favorite things to do in your downtime when you're able to get it? I love to travel and plan on a trip to South Africa with my husband this fall. I also love seeing live performance. It is sacred to me. It is one of the things for which I am so grateful to UNC Chapel Hill, where I serve on the board of the General Alumni Association and the North Carolina Theater in Raleigh. Who were your greatest influences as a young artist? My dad, Tom Lawrence, taking an offer at WRAL-TV, which moved us to Raleigh in the middle of my high school years, might have seemed daunting at first, but landing at Broughton might just have been the luckiest and most formative thing that happened to me as a teenager. That public school musical program run by Judith Freeman made such an impact on me and all her students. I didn't grow up imagining myself on screen, so that aspect of my journey was one I didn't foresee back then. At the risk of sounding corny, the stage has always felt like home to me, and the memory of the thrill I felt my senior year playing Lola in Damn Yankees at Broughton is just as strong as my first performance as Velma in Chicago on Broadway. Youth Scholarship Fund to honor Brussels victims. Cameron Kane, the daughter of Raleigh resident and former U.S. Ambassador Jim Kane, has established a Space Camp Scholarship Fund in memory of her husband, 29-year-old Alexander Pinchowski, who was killed along with his sister Sasha in the recent bombing attacks at Brussels Zaventem Airport. The Pinchowskis were in the Brussels airport on March 22nd to board a flight to New York City. "He knew everything there was to know about space," Cameron Kane says. "He could identify all the stars, and he built planetary systems when he was a kid. He would say, space exploration is what we need to focus on." Children ages 9 to 18 from around the world are eligible to apply for camp scholarships. Established in 1982, Space Camp has more than 700,000 graduates who have gone on to careers in science, engineering, medicine, aviation, and education. Pilot who landed on I-540 develops pilot software. A Raleigh software entrepreneur made headlines March 29 for a dramatic I-540 airplane landing that halted rush hour traffic in a story he won't soon forget. "Everything worked out perfectly," pilot and software developer William Moody said the next day. "I mean, well, I trashed the airplane, but aside from that..." Woody, who through his one-man software shop, Glenview Software, has actually developed planning software for pilots by pilots, moved out of Los Angeles a few years ago to get out of the heavy traffic and congestion. He says the landing, which happened when his engine started to fail shortly after departing Raleigh-Durham International Airport, was almost like merging onto a freeway. Bond Brothers celebrates grand opening April 2nd. Cary's second official brewery, Bond Brothers Beer Company, will host its grand opening on April 2, starting at 2 p.m. The brewery, which is the brainchild of Jeremy and Jay Bond, Whit Baker, and Andy Schnitzer, will allure beer drinkers with a tap lineup of 13 beers, which will include a Kettle Sour, Saucery, an Imperial Stout, Variant, Double IPA, Bitter Enemy, and more. Bond Brothers has teamed up with two up-and-coming breweries from Durham, Modern Romance Brewery and Dueling Sloths, on collaborations that will be ready at the event. Food Trucks, Sherba Sherba, The Humble Pig, Heavy Metal Grillers, CJ's Street Food, and Pie Pushers will be parked beside the brewery. The ever-popular Chatham County Line will headline the music, which begins at 5 p.m. Charlie Hayes to retire from RTRP on June 30. Charlie Hayes, president and CEO of Research Triangle Regional Partnership, is retiring effective June 30. "It's been a heck of a ride," he says. Hayes, in the role since 1996, says his biggest point of pride while at RTRP is how the state conducts itself when it comes to economic development. "We are able to play nice in the sandbox, nicer than anybody in this nation," he says, "and that's remarkable. It doesn't happen most places." RTRP promotes economic development in a region that includes Chatham, Durham, Edgecombe, Franklin, Granville, Harnett, Johnston, Lee, Moore, Nash, Orange, Person, Vance, Wake, Warren, and Wilson counties, in addition to Research Triangle Park. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Amanda Hoyle. The main headline, "New Owner of Velvet Cloak Inn Has Plans for Landmark." The Velvet Cloak Inn, for more than two decades, served as a popular gathering place for wedding receptions, legislator luncheons, and celebrity visits. But with a new owner stepping in with plans to build a new student apartment complex, the days are numbered for the storied hotel. A site plan filed in Raleigh in March by Peak Campus of Atlanta shows plans to redevelop the 2.5-acre Velvet Cloak property with a new apartment community. The plans include drawings for 150 rental units and enough bedrooms for almost 490 residents. Real estate sources say that Peak Campus and its equity partner, Blue Vista Capital Management of Chicago, have purchased the 174-room hotel from the David Smoot family, which has owned it since 2004, but terms of the deal were not immediately available. The Smoots had converted the hotel into residential condominiums and had sold several of the units, but the project never really took off, and the family has spent the last several years buying back all of the units they had sold so that the property could be marketed as a whole to a new buyer. A source from Peak Campus did not return calls for details or comment about the project. It's exciting to see properties like the Velvet Cloak that have fallen on bad times to finally get to a point that it's viable for future use, says Jeff Murrowson, executive director of the Hillsborough Street Community Service Corporation. The Velvet Cloak Inn at 1505 Hillsborough Street was the first hotel built outside the downtown core, and for many years was the choice hotel for celebrities and state legislators visiting Raleigh. Raleigh real estate broker Stephen Peden of Colliers International represented the sellers in the transaction. And in a section called You Said It, readers' Facebook comments on the Velvet Cloak story. Continued mourning for the classic Hillsborough Street we all knew and loved. Memories and character continually obliterated. We are becoming Charlotte. And that's from Kathleen Pepe Southern. Will force NC State to raise the bar for their own housing once they have competition. It's happening all over the country. This is good news. That's from David Baird. And Betsy Cox Morris writes, what an elegant place. My husband and I spent our wedding night there on April 7, 1974. Homes to proceed without Crawford on new project. Building plans to restore the old Raleigh Times newspaper building at 211 West Martin Street in downtown Raleigh and open a hip new restaurant and tavern with one of Raleigh's highest profile chefs have been scratched. John Holmes, president of Hobby Properties and owner of the building at 211 West Martin Street, says he's reevaluating whether it still makes sense to salvage the building or start fresh with a more ambitious building project. Holmes says he's had construction drawings queued up for 2 years for the renovation and rehabilitation of the old newspaper building he bought in 2013, but after the state's historic tax credit program expired in 2015, the financing model for the project didn't pencil out. Even after the historic tax credits were restored, the city's new UDO map, adopted in 2016, rezoned his entire block to allow for buildings as tall as 20 stories high. We're now asking ourselves, what is it even going to look like in 10 years, Holmes says. While we want to move forward with this project, we also have to do it prudently. What makes the most sense long term? He and Raleigh chef Scott Crawford had big plans for turning the historic building into a new modern American tavern with great food as soon as they had stabilized their first venture together. The Farm to Fork restaurant and grocery Standard Foods, which opened in October. Then Holmes announced on March 25 that Crawford will be leaving Standard Foods in early May for other restaurant interests. Now it's time for me to pursue other goals, Crawford said in a statement. Sale of prime downtown real estate finalized. Raleigh real estate development firm The Lundy Group Incorporated, on March 23, finalized its purchase of two city-owned properties at 301 Hillsborough Street in downtown Raleigh. The 1.18-acre property, which sold for $6.3 million, was the prize after a 9-round bidding battle that ended in November between more than a half dozen real estate bidders from across the country. Glenn Lennox owners concoct new formula for Chapel Hill plan. Grubb Properties has reached an agreement to buy out its majority ownership partner in the prominent Glen Lennox apartment home community in Chapel Hill, with a plan to kickstart its first phase of new construction by mid to late 2017. Scott Brown, president of the Grubb Property, says his firm is in the process of raising between $40 million to $80 million for a new fund that will specifically target the long-term redevelopment of the 69-acre Glen Lennox property per terms of its development agreement with the town. Brown did not disclose terms of the newest buyout deal with its partners at Federal Capital Partners, but it will give Grubb 100% ownership of the property again. Details for the first phase of new development at Glen Lennox, he says, are still being finalized, and a lot will depend on whether the town agrees to install a new traffic signal at the main intersection into the property. If that's approved, Brown says they hope to have new construction underway by mid to late 2017. 40 apartment homes along U.S. 15501 would be vacated and demolished to make way for a new clubhouse with swimming pool, a new office building, and a new Link-branded apartment building. And now we turn to the On Technology page written by Lauren Onisorge. The main headline, IBM launches Cloud Dojo. Decades ago, the Frontier in Research Triangle Park was a typical 80s-era IBM building with long, windowless hallways and small, isolated offices. Today, under Research Triangle Foundation ownership, a co-working space is replacing those narrow hallways, and collaboration, not isolation, is being touted as the Frontier's theme. And its longtime tenant, IBM, is officially back, at least in a small leased office on the first floor, but it's definitely not your parents' IBM. It's behind a big glass wall, says Tom Vanderham, a 17-year IBM veteran serving as Vice President of Development and Engineering for IBM's Bluemix cloud platform, referring to what's being called the IBM Cloud Foundry Dojo in RTP. He says it's part of IBM's pledge to evangelize cloud technology, and it has its official grand opening this week. The dojo is about enhancing cloud awareness as well as delivering code into the Cloud Foundry, which then fundamentally becomes part of Bluemix as well, says Vanderham. Cloud Foundry is an open-source cloud computing platform with several partners, including IBM, Pivotal, HPE, Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, and others. And while its partners have developed dojos like this to enhance and promote the platform, it's a first for IBM, though four more customer-focused Bluemix garages exist across the globe. Programmers will have specific tasks regarding Cloud Foundry by IBM, but as they're working, they'll be spreading the cloud message, he says. It's a way of helping to educate and allow other people in the Frontier building to know what IBM is doing in cloud overall, Vanderham says. Theoretically, entrepreneurs will be inspired to build their own Cloud Foundry-based applications that can run on IBM Bluemix, he explains. We want to create it as an open space with mentoring and education as well. We have a full-time mission and task, but we realize that this is part of evangelism. There's room for 12 programmers. So far, between 6 and 8 work out of the dojo. While its partners in the Cloud Foundry Foundation have debuted similar facilities across the countries, this is a first for IBM. IBM chose RTP for the dojo for two reasons, the first being the budding startup community in the Triangle, he says. The second reason is its centralized location. While IBM has facilities across the globe, its Bluemix team is largely centered in the Triangle, he says. Of his team of 800 engineers, more than 25% work out of RTP. Lease terms were not disclosed, but Vanderham says he expects to be in the space a while, for years, I imagine. Red Hat hits $2 billion, plans to add 1,400 jobs around the globe in 2016. Red Hat just crossed the $2 billion milestone when it comes to revenue. And according to executives, it's not just growing in terms of dollars. Chief Financial Officer Frank Calderoni said on a recent earnings call that the company added 1,500 employees to end the year at 8,800. The company plans to add 1,400 this fiscal year, but executives wouldn't say how many of those jobs would be coming to Raleigh, where the open source giant keeps its headquarters. And along with this article, there are two quotes. The first quote, "We love to see people using multiple clouds because it helps highlight our offerings." And that's from Jim Whitehurst, CEO of Red Hat, telling analysts on a recent earnings call that while he believes hybrid clouds are the future, both public and private cloud deployments benefit Red Hat. And the next quote, "What customers are grappling with is, how do I run today's and tomorrow's workloads on yesterday's infrastructure?" And that's from Ranga Rangachari, Vice President and General Manager of Storage at Red Hat, speaking after the Raleigh-based open source company announced a new strategic partnership with flash storage giant SanDisk Corporation. And in a section called Wearable Tech, Valencell proceeds with expansion plans. Even as sensor developer Valencell moves forward in its court battle against tech titans Apple and Fitbit, it's plotting to grow its Raleigh headcount. The firm, which currently has more than 30 employees and just raised $11 million in new equity financing, plans to hire an additional 10 people this year. Ryan Crawdell, Vice President of Marketing, attributes the growth to the upward trajectory of the core wearables market, primarily focused on sports and fitness. And finally, in a section called RDU by the Numbers, passenger traffic is increasing at Raleigh-Durham International Airport. The latest statistics provided by the RDU Airport Authority show, and new flights are a big driver. The average number of daily departures increased to 179 in February, a 13.6% increase over February 2015. The numbers are 347,090, the number of in-plane RDU passengers in February, 6,047, the number of international passengers in February at RDU, 137,357, the number of cars exiting RDU parking lots in February. And now we turn to the On Pharmaceuticals page written by Jason DeBruin. The first headline, Novo Nordisk gives update on 700 job promise, breaks ground. If Novo Nordisk executives ever doubted that job seekers would be interested in their 700 new positions, those doubts were put to rest early. For the first 22 positions, the Danish drug maker received more than 1,200 responses, according to Gary Lohr, the Novo Nordisk U.S. Active Pharmaceutical Ingredients Project Director, who will help oversee the entire five-year project to ramp up the facility. Novo broke ground March 28 on a new $1.8 billion manufacturing facility in Clayton, a project that will bring nearly 700 new jobs to the area. Those new jobs will have an average salary of $68,000, some $22,000 higher than the current average salary, according to Novo, and $15,000 more than the median household income in Johnston County. Already, the company has hired 100 workers who will work to execute the project, ramp up the facility, and then transition to operations. During peak construction, Novo expects as many as 2,500 people working on the project. Lohr expects to reach the full 700-employee roster at a fairly linear rate to reach full operating capacity by the end of 2020. Anyone in the area of Novo's existing plant can expect to see earth begin to move this week and the new buildings to come out of the ground in short order. The first milestone will be to see the central utility building will be running by mid-2018. We're ramping up at a very quick rate, Lohr says, but it is according to plan, though. Lars Reblin Sorensen, president and CEO of Novo Nordisk, and Governor Pat McCrory, participated in the groundbreaking ceremony March 28. The facility will produce API for a range of Novo Nordisk's current and future GLP-1 and insulin medicines. According to Novo, the new facility will measure 833,000 square feet and have a footprint of 417,639 square feet, the equivalent of approximately 7 football fields. As the prevalence of diabetes has grown in the U.S., so too has the demand for effective treatments, Sorensen said. It gives me great pride to break ground on our new facility site in Clayton, where we have an existing strong organization. This site will play a pivotal role in enabling us to meet the needs of people living with diabetes in the U.S. for years to come. Here's what's driving Roe's latest hiring spree. As steady business has rolled in for Chapel Hill contract research organization Roe, the company is now making 30 new hires. The additions will increase the company's workforce by about 8% to 400 employees, up from about 350 2 years ago. The need for more workers comes from the 1-2 punch that every company wants. New clients coming into the fold and existing clients coming back for repeat business. We're in a massive hiring phase right now, says Kay Lowry, service leader, human resources, adding that these are not short-term roles. We hire for the long term, she says. The company is looking specifically for clinical research associates, though has other open positions as well. Company-wide, some 35% of all employees have advanced degrees. As a CRO, Roe helps pharma companies test experimental drugs and therapies. It competes in an industry that includes giants like Quintiles, Inc. Research, and PRA Health Sciences. Roe was founded in 1984 by the husband and wife team, Ron and Mary Helms, then a nationally recognized biostatistician, and the head of clinical data management for a child development research institute, respectively. In September, the company won a $16.5 million federal contract to provide statistical and clinical coordinating services to the Division of Allergy, Immunology, and Transplantation, part of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. This contract helps spur the need for more hires. Duke's symposium focuses on vaccines, treatment for Zika virus. As the Ebola outbreak winds down, concerns over the Zika outbreak fill headlines. A symposium on April 1 at Duke University focuses on partnerships and incentives to ensure future global availability of vaccines and medicines for these and other infectious diseases. Participants discuss lessons learned from the formation of alliances for Ebola vaccine development, as well as tools for building future agreements among different stakeholders. Along with Duke faculty, scheduled speakers are from GSK Biologicals, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Johnson & Johnson Global Public Health, Merck Vaccines, and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And also, we have a question and answer column. This is headlined, Merck's CEO talks about new leukemia treatment. Researchers at UNC Lineberger and other institutions have developed a new potential treatment for acute myeloid leukemia. In the journal JCI Insight, they report that the compound MRX-2843 more than doubled the median days of survival in laboratory models with a drug-resistant form of the disease. MRX-2843 is being developed by UNC Chapel Hill spin-out Merix, a company that has raised $7.1 million, including from the venture fund started by Fred Eshelman. With its latest findings, Merix hopes to begin testing the experimental drug in humans, a major step in drug development. Merix CEO Sailash Patel joined the company about a year ago. From a business perspective, talk about the importance of reaching a stage in development to file an IND, investigational new drug application, and hopefully beginning human testing. We filed the IND for MRX-2843 earlier this year, which was an important milestone for the program and the company. It means we now have FDA's approval to start a first in-human study. In our industry, having clinical data in humans is a key value inflection point. With the filing of the MRX-2843 IND, we are one step closer to this and, importantly, a step closer to bringing this drug to patients battling these cancers. What is the market size for a treatment for acute myeloid leukemia? According to the American Cancer Society, there are approximately 20,000 new cases of AML in the U.S. each year and an estimated 10,400 deaths. What are the existing treatments and how would MRX-2843 differ? The current curative treatment for AML is high-dose chemotherapy, sometimes followed by a bone marrow transplant. However, AML is more frequent in patients over age 65, and the high-dose chemotherapy is difficult in this age range. New therapies are needed. More than 80% of adult patients express a survival gene, MERTK, and 30% have a specific mutation in a gene, FLT3, that drives leukemic cell growth. The new MRX drug, 2843, is a dual inhibitor of the activity of both of these gene products. MRX-2843 has additional properties that indicate that it may have better activity in several of the resistant forms of FLT3. What is one thing you would like to change about the drug development industry in the Triangle? I would like to see big pharma companies set up R&D innovation hubs in the Triangle like they have done in the Boston area. And in a section called He Said It, we are confident this partnership will preserve the Lenoir Memorial legacy of local healthcare for future generations. And that's from Gary Black, president and CEO of Lenoir Memorial Hospital. The hospital is in exclusive talks with UNC Healthcare to finalize a management agreement. And finally, in a section called Big Numbers, $16.5 million raised by Research Triangle Park drug developer Invisia Therapeutics to continue developing new treatments for vision loss and blindness. Invisia's lead product candidate, identified by Invisia as ENV-515, is a biodegradable eye insert that delivers glaucoma treatment in a slow and steady stream over time. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the business profile, Unleashed, the Dog and Cat Store. The headline, From Flea Market and Fair to $5 Million. Raleigh couple finds niche market for growing pet supplies business. And this article is written by Amanda Hoyle. Before Amy and J.P. Finney became dog people and owners of the Unleashed pet store chain that's grown to 6 locations in the Triangle and in Wilmington, they were a struggling young married couple from Raleigh living in California who decided to adopt a stray puppy. That was one of our first make-it-work moments as a couple, she says, primarily because the shelter assistants told them the puppy was a St. Bernard mix that could grow to more than 140 pounds. We were living in a 700-square-foot apartment above a garage, and we were just like, well, this is the dog that we're meant to have. Benny, now 11, ended up weighing in at only 60 pounds as an adult, but his stamp on the Finneys and their future was made. When we got the puppy, I pretty much went to the library and checked out every single book they had about dogs and read them all, she says. I started learning a lot about dog training and food and really got entrenched in the dog world. So when the high school sweethearts from Sanderson High School returned to Raleigh later that year, she got a couple of jobs working at doggy daycares, started a side business tutoring school children, and researched a way to make and sell her own dog treats at the Raleigh Flea Market at the state fairgrounds. But the rules and barrier to entry for dog treats is kind of high, so I decided to go to the flea market and start selling my favorite products instead. They sold JP's old Buick for $500, which they used to buy inventory, and she borrowed a patio umbrella, a card table, and a chair from her parents to set up her booth. Soon, she started learning the nuances of sales, such as the tendency of customers to not buy a product when there's only one or two items on display. Put a whole bunch of collars and toys out to choose from, and you'll sell more. Nobody wants to buy the last one because they think all the best ones have already been sold, she says. You also have to be there when they arrive, so Amy would often be set up in the rain in case a customer came by needing to restock their food supply. Their suppliers had to send tractor-trailer deliveries to her parents' garage in North Raleigh since they had nowhere else to store product. The Finneys' big break, though, came in 2007 when an administrator of the big North Carolina State Fair each October invited the Finneys to sell their wares during the 11-day event. With good weather, the state fair can draw a crowd of more than 1 million people. Amy knew she needed help, so JP decided to quit his job as a high-level manager with a local tire sales company. Between the customer base they were already building at the flea market and the new customers they gained at the state fair, the Finneys decided to open their own store. The first Unleashed location opened in June 2008 at the Lake Boone Trail Shopping Center in West Raleigh. "They pretty much threw the keys at us and said, 'Good luck,'" JP remembers. But what sets Unleashed apart from other national and regional pet store companies, they say, is their super-focused research of every product they sell, which must be all-natural and meet Amy and JP's strict standards for quality. "We look at every ingredient, and if it meets our requirements, then we actually meet with the company making it and find out why they are picking the ingredients, where they are getting them from, the philosophy, the family. We get to know the actual company," she says. "We've toured 5 or 6 different food facilities, so we're selective." But for a toy, collar, or other non-consumable product, the Finneys say they are more open to new ideas. "Especially for people making things locally," JP says. "We're romantic to that litmus test of just go out and see what happens because of our flea market experience." Unleashed, for example, was one of the first retail stores to sell the Thunder Shirt, a product made by a Durham company designed to relieve pet anxiety. "They were a tiny little company when we started carrying it, in basic Ziploc baggies," JP says. "Now Thunder Shirts are everywhere. They're huge. That was really cool." The Finneys say they never had a goal of growing the company beyond their flea market booth, and that it's been really at the behest of their customers that they continue to grow. 6 store locations so far in less than 7 years in business. The company has a payroll of about 35 people and about $5 million in sales a year. None of the stores have ever posted year-over-year loss in revenue, and there's a couple they'd like to expand. "If it had been just me, I'd probably still be at the flea market tweaking my business plan," Amy says. "JP is the trigger puller, and we've learned to go with our gut a lot and follow our instincts." And in a section with this article called A Closer Look, Company, Unleash, the dog and cat store, business, chain of retail stores selling all-natural dog and cat food, toys, treats, and supplies, founded 2008, founders and owners Amy and J.P. Finney, locations, 6 retail stores at Lake Boone Trail, Stonehenge Market, City Market, and Crabtree Valley Mall in Raleigh, plus Crescent Commons in Cary, and Landfall Shopping Center in Wilmington. Number of employees, 35. Annual revenue, about $5 million. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page to read some of the columns here. The first column is written by Laura Noble, who is managing partner of the Noble Law Firm in Raleigh. And the headline on her column, "What You May Not Know About HB2 Law." Embedded into HB2, recently passed by the North Carolina General Assembly, is a provision that dramatically changes the law for all North Carolinians. For almost 30 years, a person fired because of religion, race, color, national origin, age, sex, or disability could bring a wrongful discharge claim in state court based on our anti-discrimination statute, Equal Employment Practices Act. 30 years of case law, consensus, and relatively little controversy were reversed in 12 hours of legislating without any meaningful opportunity for public comment or input. The new law prohibits employees from relying on the EEPA to bring any discrimination claims against an employer in state court. Some have argued that a state claim is not necessary because you can still file a federal claim. However, there are profound differences between the now defunct state anti-discrimination law and the federal ones. The differences are largely bad for employees, but employers should be aware the changes are not necessarily in their best interests either. There are far fewer federal courts than state courts, meaning more travel time, travel expense, and time away from the office. Federal court may cost businesses more because there are statutory attorney's fees available to plaintiffs under federal anti-discrimination laws not available under state law. Attorney fee awards in federal court can dwarf the actual compensatory awards. This law shifts exclusive authority to resolve discrimination disputes with the federal bureaucracy and the federal courts. The most damaging aspect of HB 2 for businesses and workers may be how it impacts the quality and quantity of our workforce. North Carolina now joins Mississippi as the only two states who do not offer protection against the most basic forms of discrimination in private workplaces. And the other viewpoint column is written by Julie Tisdale, who is city and county policy analyst for the John Locke Foundation in Raleigh. The headline, "The Real Cost of Buying Land for Projects." There was an interesting headline out of Buncombe County that caught my eye. Officials there were disappointed to learn that Deschutes Brewery had chosen to open up its East Coast facility in Roanoke, Virginia, rather than Asheville. This was despite the county spending $6.8 million to buy 137 acres specifically for the project. And so the headline read, "Land used to lure Deschutes Brewery could be sold." Hours after learning that Deschutes Brewery had chosen Roanoke, Buncombe County Manager Wanda Green said she would recommend the sale of the 137-acre area officials had offered to the company. Within hours, because the county had bought the land specifically with the brewery in mind, this wasn't just land they happened to own anyway and were willing to sell to the brewery. This was land they'd acquired last year for the purpose of offering it to the brewery. Why exactly should Buncombe County be in the land acquisition business for a private company? For the sake of the taxpayers who paid for the land, I hope Buncombe County is able to sell it and not at a loss. Officials are saying they're confident they'll be able to do just that, and their tone seems pretty nonchalant about the whole thing. Despite losing to Roanoke, Buncombe County Commission Chair David Gant said that buying the land remained a wise decision for the county. The Ferry Road property is one of the last large parcels suitable for economic development left in our county, he said. Hopefully, this will turn out to be revenue neutral for Buncombe County, but even if it does, Green and Gant seem to be missing a larger issue. Buncombe County has held that land for a year, which means for a year it's been unavailable for any other economic development. One of the last large parcels was just taken out of play for everyone other than the county's preferred business. If the land had been available, it's impossible to know what ideas other businesses might have come up with to use the space. In economics, that's called opportunity cost. It's the value of all that would otherwise have been created with that resource, in this case, the land. And we have absolutely no way of quantifying it. Maybe the land would have remained empty and unused, but maybe not. By buying it and setting it aside as part of a bid for this brewery, though, the county effectively removed any possibility of the land being used for economic benefit. That should not be the approach of local governments, or of state or federal governments for that matter. Additionally, I wonder about the other costs incurred in trying to woo this brewery. To mention but one, how much time, with salaries paid by taxpayers, was spent trying to get this particular business to come, rather than improving the overall environment for all businesses. The real losers here aren't county officials or the county, but rather all the taxpayers whose money was spent in a failed bid, the businesses who were denied access to the land, and the people who would have been employed by any businesses that might have popped up if the land had been available. When I see this story, I'm sad about all that loss, and I'm reminded that governments really aren't very good at picking winners, at knowing what companies are going to want to do business, and where they're going to want to locate. So perhaps they should stick to things they are better at and let businesses acquire land on their own. And with our remaining minutes, we'll read the People on the Move Spotlight. This edition is on Jackie Elek, Vice President J. Fuller Homes. After reaching company goals for 2015, Jackie Elek has been given new responsibilities within her employer, J. Fuller Homes, a private custom home building company based in Raleigh. Elek, a former project manager, has now been named Vice President of J. Fuller Homes. In her new post, she is charged with finding future lot and neighborhood opportunities, designing home plans, neighborhood planning, home pricing, coordinating financing, and finding marketing partners. She also works with customers, landowners, developers, investors, and partners, and works to approve subcontractor payments, negotiate contracts, and obtain the proper permits for jobs. J. Fuller Homes currently employs 7 people and is helmed by Jim Anderson. The company has built homes on remaining lots in neighborhoods such as Glenstone and Wakefield, Hassentree Country Club, Lloyd Square, and Brookshire Manor. Upcoming builds will be in neighborhoods that include Ramsley in Chapel Hill, Garden Ridge in West Cary, and Sherrill Place in Garner, Elek says. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? It requires a very dedicated team to efficiently build each and every home at the level of quality that we provide to our customers. What are some of your major goals for your new position? To sell 25 quality homes per year and to build the brand of J. Fuller Homes within the Triangle. Biggest pet peeve? Complaining instead of problem solving. Biggest worry? Another recession. Education, bachelor's degree in business management from NC State University. Triangle area business person you most admire, Jim Anderson, owner of Fuller Land and Development and J. Fuller Homes. And last book you've read, Pretty Girls by Karen Slaughter. And we'll have to stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.